Hey, everybody. It's Mormonism Live. How are you doing, Mr. Real?
I'm doing so good, Radio Free Mormon. How's your day going?
Oh, just great. A lot better than our guest's day is going. The one that we had planned to have on the show tonight, Spencer Anderson, professor at Indiana State University, if I remember correctly. I know it's some university in Indiana. But he's had a little family issue. We had advertised that he would be here to talk about certain financial problems that the church is in again.
The church has financial problems? I thought they had billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, one of the reasons they have so many billions of dollars is because they've been going about it in ways that might not be according to the law.
Shame, shame, Mormon church. Shame, shame.
Yes. So we heard a couple hours ago that our guest is not going to be able to be here, but fortunately, Bill Real, never one to be caught flat-footed, already had something else ready to go in the pipeline.
Yeah, we were going to do this episode a few weeks ago, and then some current events hit, and it was more important that we drop an episode that could be put back on the shelf and picked up at any moment, and it came in handy today. So, folks, what we're going to do is I will put up on the screen here. Give me just a second to switch.
Is this going to be the new thumbnail that you just came up with?
This is Making Mormonism Indiscernible from a Fraud. And I thought of this. This is actually your idea. This was maybe 3 years ago, 2 years ago at this point. We were doing an episode, and you made mention of how Mormonism does this thing where it makes a claim about something, and it's a truth claim. It really is important. If you take this claim apart, the church's truth claims fall apart. It no longer holds up. And so it makes a claim, and the critics come in, and critics go, hey, wait a minute. There's data that makes your claim problematic. And then what the church does, or what its apologists do, is they then reduce the issue back to something else. They move the goalpost so that now the way the issue is framed, the faithful framing, ends up being indiscernible from a fraud. In other words, the outward data that you perceive under the new framing matches the exact same thing that the critic sees. And when you said it, and you're welcome to pick up the story, but you had said it in relationship to which issue?
The Book of Abraham, and specifically the catalyst theory.
Yep. And so when you had done that, I thought, you know, he's got it. There's something to this.
Right, George.
Yeah, and so what I did was I went and put together, I'd actually start working on this maybe 6 months ago, just made some notes of four or five of them. And then when I was preparing for this episode, I came up with a bunch of others. You and I talked, and I think you threw a few of these in. And what we ended up with was 19 of them. And there may be more, folks. This is what we want to play a little game tonight. You can start beginning to make a list of what you think we're going to talk about. You've already been told one of them, the Book of Abraham, the Catalyst Theory, which we'll start with tonight. If you'll make a list of the ones that you can think of that would fit those parameters, and as we go through the show, cross off the ones we talk about, and whatever ones are left on your list that we didn't mention, we want to make our call-in section of the show about you calling in to tell us the ones we didn't have on the list. And this is a specific type of apologetic, and there are other types of apologetics that are very similar to it. We're going to be very stringent. It has to tightly fall in. This isn't loose translation. This is tight translation. Yes. This has to fall tightly into the parameters of what we're talking about. And I think by the end of the show, you will clearly see how this works. So
these examples have to be tight, like unto a dish.
Yes, which you and I had a great conversation about earlier, which I hope at some point makes its way into a Mormon Sunday school.
It could. So, Who knows? Anything could happen.
Anything could happen. So let's start off. So let me try to explain this first one. I'll take the first one, RFM, and then we'll just alternate every other one. And we'll also sort of kind of play a game where to see if we can sort of walk the audience through this in a nice, clean way, and they understand each of these and understand the process, because the process is the exact same in every one of these instances. So in the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith in the mid-1830s in Kirtland, Ohio, he purchases some mummies. He purchases some papyri. He translates the papyri, says that they are the writings of Abraham written by his own hand. He then proceeds to, what's that?
I'm saying upon papyrus.
Upon papyrus, yes. And he translates the papyrus into the Book of Abraham, but not only does he translate the Egyptian symbols, he translates the facsimiles and the objects in the facsimiles, and tells us the meaning of all of them. The papyri disappears. Don't know what happened to the mummies, but it's all gone. Thought it's lost. We'll never be able to prove that the Book of Abraham shows that Mormonism isn't true. But then, as you pointed out, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the, I believe, mid-1960s.
67, I think.
Yep. Found the papyri, and the church got them back, and they were released, images of them released to the public, which allowed for the first time Egyptologists to look at the papyri and the facsimiles and to decide that, wait a minute, this doesn't match anything that Joseph said. It's completely not right. And it essentially proves that the Book of Abraham translation is a fraudulent translation. And what the church does, first it tries to do this missing scroll thing, but the problem is that we know, because of the data, the specific spots on the papyri and facsimiles where Joseph Smith is translating, they are the parts we have. Whatever references to long scroll are actually obscure and may have even been created by Hugh Nibley. So we don't really have any validity to a long scroll. So what the church does is it says, well, let's come up with a new theory. Let's have a catalyst theory. The catalyst theory doesn't require that Joseph Smith be translating the Egyptian papyri. Hence, he can get the translation 100% wrong in terms of translating the Egyptian symbols, writing, facsimile images into words in English, and it no longer is necessary. And so what the catalyst theory, and you made this point, whether you're a critic and you think Joseph Smith fraudulently created the Book of Abraham, or whether you're a believer who believes in the catalyst theory of the translation of the Book of Abraham, outwardly, both of those theories look exactly the same. And so what the catalyst theory does is it resolves any problems with the translation having to be connected to the papyri, and it makes the Book of Abraham translation, if seen through the catalyst theory, indiscernible from a fraud. Any comments you have about this one?
Yes, as Baldrick might say to Blackadder, it's a cunning plan. However, it's even worse than that, Bill, because, of course, on the record several times, Joseph Smith, as well as his scribes, made it very clear that they considered that they were actually doing a real translation, that they were translating the Egyptian hieroglyphs into English. And therefore, the final permutation on the catalyst theory is that Joseph Smith himself was unaware that this catalyst theory was actually going on. Joseph Smith thought he was translating from Egyptian into English, but actually he wasn't. He was mistaken. He was wrong. He was actually not translating Egyptian into English. He was translating whatever God beamed down into his head when Joseph Smith thought he was translating Egyptian into English. So that makes it absolutely classic. The catalyst theory is exactly the same as a fraud. Joseph Smith committing an intentional fraud is indistinguishable from the catalyst theory. And that is the beauty of it.
Yeah. And you mentioned another thing too, which is, and I think this is sort of funny, the apologists don't believe either an actual Egyptian translation or the catalyst theory. If they believed in an actual Egyptian translation, they wouldn't be suggesting a catalyst theory anyway. And if they believed in a catalyst theory, they wouldn't be suggesting that the four canopic jars and the crocodile god have any connection to the Book of Abraham translation.
Yes, this becomes really, really transparent at this point, that there are certain people who want to hold on to the missing scroll theory, that Joseph Smith really could translate Egyptian, except we just don't have the Egyptian that he translated. We've got these fragments instead, right? Yeah. And then there are others who say, no, Joseph Smith couldn't translate Egyptian, or he wasn't translating Egyptian. He was just receiving a revelation, and the papyrus was serving as a catalyst.
And there is one guy, there's one guy out in the universe who thinks all the Egyptologists got it wrong, and he understands what Joseph Smith was doing with the actual Egyptian.
Yeah, I'm sure he's a very, very smart fellow.
Yeah.
And he has like his one disciple who goes around and makes crazy comments everywhere he can about how this guy is so smart. It's Greg. Is it Greg somebody? I can't remember his name.
I don't remember his name too. And I don't think the annals of history will remember it either.
Yes. The annals of history won't remember it either.
That one was used recently too.
Where was that when someone meant to say, oh, it was on that.
Marvelous Work and a Wonder, wasn't it? Marvelous.
No, it was that crazy video that got everybody excited about this small, tiny postage stamp.
Oh, gold, yeah, yeah, the gold plates.
The gold, little gold book, you know?
Yep.
If you got little tiny things you want to write on it, you can. Almost certainly a hoax, but it was brought up on Shabbat. Remember Shabbat Night Live?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they had their guest on there who was talking about the annals of history. And I had to clip that just because I thought it was classic.
Freudian slips.
Tim thinks it's Greg Woodhouse. Whoever he is, he knows more than all the Egyptologists in the world put together. So you got to hand it to him. He's a smart fellow.
Yes, he does.
Oh, excuse me. I was leading up to something.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was leading up to was, if you want to be a catalyst theorist, you know, God bless you. If you want to be a missing scroll theorist, fine. But don't you dare go out of your lane, because this is what happens all the time. Frequently, what I see is people who will say the catalyst theory, they'll intersperse them, right? So they'll say that anything that they can make any kind of a connection to ancient Egyptian or some other culture from the fragments that we have, that shows Joseph Smith really could translate Egyptian. Everything else, right? The 99% else, he can't. So if you believe Joseph Smith could translate Egyptian and you're using these as examples of how he could, that's problematic, because now you're left with the 99% that Joseph Smith got absolutely wrong. If he can translate Egyptian in one place, why can't he translate Egyptian in 99 other places? So the problem I have is people who are catalyst theorists, nevertheless, trying to use these little bits of Egyptology in the Book of Abraham in order to support it as an ancient text. If it's catalyst, it's catalyst. And if it's a real catalyst theory, then anything like that has to be what you and I would say it is. It's a coincidence, and not even a remarkable coincidence. The connections are so small. On the other hand, if you are a person who believes it's ancient, like John Gee, except he's waffling on that as well.
Yes, he is.
You don't get to use the catalyst theory to cover up all the things where, you know, Joseph Smith got it wrong. So this is very similar to the loose translation and tight translation theories of the Bible. Excuse me, of the Bible. Of the Book of Mormon. And I don't know, I never really saw it quite as clearly with the Book of Mormon until I saw it being done with the Book of Abraham. Yeah. And using tight and loose translation theories in the Book of Mormon is fine as long as you stick with one, but they never do.
No, because there's holes with both. Yeah, there's problems.
Places require tight translation, then he was doing a tight translation, like chiasmus or names or whatever it might be. Okay, we want a tight translation here in order so we can prove our case. But in all these other places where Joseph Smith is, I don't know, incorporating 19th century elements into the Book of Mormon, oh, that was the loose translation part,
right?
It's one or the other. You got to sink or swim with one or the other, but going to both indicates to me that neither one actually works on its own.
Correct. All right, I'll let you take the second one, which is the expansion theory of the Book of Mormon translation.
Blake, is that Blake Osler?
That's Blake Osler.
Blake Osler came up with another cunning plan, and that was when he realized that the 19th century elements in the Book of Mormon really were not able to be gainsaid or overcome. They're just there, and you can't get around it, and he couldn't get around it. So instead of just concluding that the Book of Mormon was a 19th century production, he came up with a fantastic idea. And it's this expansion theory of Blake Osler. Does anybody believe it nowadays except for Blake? I don't know. But the idea is that Osler accepts the Book of Mormon as an actual historical account. There were real gold plates upon which was written real Reformed Egyptian that Joseph Smith really translated by the gift and power of God. But as edited and expanded in light of Joseph Smith's vocabulary and capacity for expression within his world's view. Now, this is not a tight translation. This is a loose translation. This is so loose that it's filling up vast pages in the Book of Mormon with stuff from Joseph Smith's own mind, from his own culture, from his own background. And that's how he's going to account for all the 19th century elements in the Book of Mormon. He argues that it is a modern expansion of an ancient document. Because Osler adopts the expansion theory, he affirms that the Book of Mormon was translated through the gift of God and reflects a revelation of the content of an ancient source, though we have access only to its modern translation. That is an awful lot of thinking to go on in order to try and get around what is staring him in the face, which is that the Book of Mormon was written by Joseph Smith or his contemporaries from beginning to end. And so he's going to take those elements that are obviously and demonstrably 19th century and say that came from Joseph Smith. The rest came from God. So he's got the Book of Mormon divided up into two categories. There are those elements that have been proven to be 19th century. And then there's the other elements that have not yet been proven to be 19th century.
Did you hear that, folks? There are the things that have been proven to be 19th century. And then there are the things that we haven't yet proven are 19th century. Okay. I mean,
it's all 19th century, but he's trying to get around it. He's a smart guy. And the problem is that when you use your intelligence in order to try and find a way around overwhelming evidence, it can lead you into strange paths. Dan Vogel says something, whatever can't be explained as ancient is Joseph Smith's inspired expansion. Exactly, right.
And this allows RFM, so the believer gets to say, you know what, I know the Book of Mormon is an ancient text, and I'm not bothered when I find Joseph Smith Sr.'s dream in the book. I'm not bothered when there's too many people that die on the hill and no bones have ever been found. It's not a problem that horses are mentioned. It's not a problem that the sermons of the 19th century make their way into the book. It's not an issue. And so everything the critic says about the Book of Mormon is attempted to be solved, and to some degree is, by having the expansion theory.
Mm-hmm. But of course, consider what this is telling us. What it's telling us is that even the apologists are confronting 19th century elements in the Book of Mormon that they cannot explain away.
Yeah. You can't be honest with yourself and do that, can you?
Not really. I don't think so. I mean, why not just say it's a 19th century book and be done with it?
Right. And that's how it is on every one of these issues. The critic has the more reasonable explanation. Their explanation is the one that doesn't, that requires the least amount of allowances and conjecture. And yet all the apologists need to do is make a little bit of room. Maybe if we make some room for this. And so it becomes plausible or possible. And that's the realm that they're playing in. All right.
Kat Swank says, what do all these apologists have in common? They don't believe Joseph Smith.
No.
Yes. These apologists are smarter than Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was wrong about what he did in all of these translations. But they figured it out, because if you believe Joseph Smith, then you run into brick wall after brick wall when you're looking at the text and other 19th century documents. One other thing I wanted to bring up to you, Bill, so I don't forget it now, was that not only is this going from things that can be proven, truth claims, to theories that make whatever it is they're talking about, the Book of Abraham, the Book of Mormon, indistinguishable from a fraud. What they're also doing is going from 1978 when I joined the church and before, but 1978 when I joined the church, when there are a host of truth claims that the church had that are, you can prove them, okay? They are provable. And what they're doing with all of these truth claims that I can see that are provable is they're moving away from those that are demonstrable and moving them into categories where you cannot prove it.
Mm-mm.
And there's a word for it, and I'm forgetting it right now, but it's provable or unprovable. It used to be things could be provable or disprovable, right? Now the theories that are being substituted in place of those are things that cannot be disproven.
Right. You find 19th century material in the Book of Mormon. That doesn't mean the book is a modern fabrication. The expansion theory resolves that.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you disprove that? You can't.
You can't.
And so instead of being where they used to be 46 years ago and more and less, where we have truth claims and we feel that we can prove them. I mean, that was the Mormonism I grew up in. We can prove our truth claims and look at this and look at that. Look at Stella 5 from Izapa with the Tree of Life stone and all this stuff.
Yeah.
We could prove stuff right and left when I joined the church. But now that has not worked. All these truth claims have fallen one by one like dominoes. So what they're substituting is things that can't be disproven.
Yep. And you'll see that time after time. So the next one is moving the Hill Cumorah away from Palmyra, but to no specific location. So the Book of Mormon claims that several of the events and most of the story occurs around a hill named Cumorah to the Nephites and Ramah to the Jaredites. And there were battles on that hill numbered in the millions. There should be swords found. There should be a stack of plates buried in that hill, the ones that were abridged that ended up making the Book of Mormon. There should be tons of certain plants in the area. There should be certain animals in the area. There should be certain weapons in the area. And there should be lots of skeletons of bodies.
Yes.
But what happens is that the hill is declared a clean hill, meaning there's nothing in the hill. And we're also told through science and archaeology that the items that the Book of Mormon claims should have existed and should be laying around and able to be discovered aren't. And so what happens is, if you go back to that letter, we talked about this in the Hill Cumorah episode, in 1990, the first presidency secretary, F. Michael Watson, and there was no second letter, Mr. Peterson.
No second Watson letter.
Not at all. Declared that the Hill Cumorah in New York is the only hill we've ever thought the Hill Cumorah was. We didn't even know where there was supposed to be a different hill. And assumedly, the apologists come in immediately and go, whoa, 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 stop. We have problems with a Hill Cumorah in New York. So what we're going to do is suggest that we move the Hill Cumorah to Mesocentral America. By the way, there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that tells us that that's where the hill should be.
Well, there's no mention of snow in the Book of Mormon.
There you go. That's the issue, right? And so they end up taking the hill, claiming that it's in Central South America, but we don't know where it's at exactly. We have a few ideas. It could be this one. It could be that one.
I think there's one that's called Vigia, V-I-G-I-A, that's proposed. Believe it or not, it's a lot bigger than Cumorah. You know, it has to be kind of.
Yeah. And it's just a coincidence that the hill the plates are buried in, which is a huge distance. So now you have to have Moroni traveling some large expanse and burying the plates in a completely different geographic location, traveling all by himself, carrying plates through differing climates, altitudes, animal life, trying to camp at night and find dinner during the day.
Alligators.
Oh my goodness. It's the animals he's never seen before.
Yeah. Scorpions, Gila monsters.
And he makes it all the way to Palmyra and buries the plates there. And it's just a coincidence that Joseph Smith and others referred to that hill as Cumorah. That actually isn't Cumorah. It just happens to be a hill.
Bill, they didn't know what they were saying.
They didn't know.
They didn't understand. That's not really the hill.
So now if there's any problem with the geography of the Book of Mormon, it doesn't matter. We've moved the hill. So it's indiscernible from a fraud. Anything else you want to say about the Hill Cumorah?
No, that's a great point, because all that the church really is saying, well, what is the church saying? Give peace a chance. No, what they're saying is that we know that this is the Hill Cumorah because that's where Joseph Smith got the plates. Okay. And I think they're probably backing away from that even now. But the problem is that the Book of Mormon account could not have happened on the Hill Cumorah. And because of that, it can't be the Hill Cumorah anymore. And so it's got to be somewhere else, anywhere else, any other hill, but this one, and no hill in particular.
Yes. And I just want to say too, it's this expansion theory, just to go back, because you touched on something, made me think of this. In the expansion theory, it's the reason why the church on all of Joseph Smith's translation productions is moving away from the word translation and moving to the word revelation. Because moving translation to revelation is in and of itself making Mormonism indiscernible from a fraud.
I know. And of course, they'll have to come up with some clever theory. Blake will be Johnny on the spot, I'm sure, with his intelligence to explain why it is that Joseph Smith insisted on not being just prophet, seer, and revelator. And revelator involves revelation, I think, but also translator. That's in the Doctrine and Covenants. Prophet, seer, revelator, and translator.
Yeah. And translation means something, you know? So
it used to.
Used to.
Now Mormons are doing everything they can to get away from what it means.
take explaining to the audience how the current framing of the Joseph Smith translation makes Mormonism indiscernible from a fraud.
Oh, guys, I got to tell you, this is so disappointing to me. Back when I got back from my mission, I was into studying Mormonism, right, left, all sorts of things. The Joseph Smith translation was a particular fascination to me. Mm-hmm. And it was Matthews, I think it was. His name may come to me. But he was the leading scholar. He was a professor in the religion department of BYU. And he was into the Joseph Smith translation. And he's the one who worked it out with the reorganized church at the time, who had possession of it, to be able to have access to it, to go and look at it and use what they had in order to not only prove that the reorganized church had been being accurate in how they'd been reproducing it, but also to get those footnotes from the Joseph Smith translation into the 1981 edition, I think it was, no, 79 edition of the Bible. I think 81 was the Book of Mormon. Thank you, Robert J. Matthews. That's his name. Really great guy, really great scholar, but I've got to tell you 100% that the way that Robert J. Matthews and the way the scholarship at the time in the 80s was bent at was that the Joseph Smith translation was what Joseph Smith claimed it was a restoration of plain and precious parts of the Bible that had been lost, even as the Book of Mormon claimed to have happened.
Yeah. And we've got a couple of videos here to show, and then I want to get your thoughts on these. This is we could have shown videos of Thomas Wayman, professor from BYU, and he sits down with Rick Bennett from Bennett's podcast and the number one podcast on science, theology, and history.
You're scared of playing any clips from that show.
No, I have no problem with that at all. I have no problem. I'll play 100 of them. We can stop right now and just play hours of Rick Bennett if you want. I have no problem with that. But I thought these would be more amusing. But Thomas Wayman and Rick Bennett say essentially the same thing. And then here you have, what is this, Scripture? This isn't Scripture Central. This is the youth, the young adult arm of the church in their videos. But here is the first one.
Translation of the Bible. Is it a translation? Is it the Bible? Was it Joseph Smith? These questions and more will be answered in the next few minutes. Stay tuned.
I gotta do something here because
this must be an old episode.
It is, but because Kwaku's on it.
Yeah, they hadn't kicked him out yet.
No, there's this thing called the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible.
What's going on right now?
Is it a translation?
That timestamp is not right.
By the way, while you're monkeying with that, Bill, I will tell you that the reorganized church understood Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible the same way that the LDS church did. And the reorganized church understood it so concretely that they produced a Bible, their IV, I think it's called IV, inspired version of the Bible, where they reproduce a Bible that contains all of the Joseph Smith translation changes in it. And if I recall correctly, they don't distinguish it in any way by putting it in a different color like red or separated it all from the text. It is just a reproduction of the Bible, King James Version, with all of those changes and additions and deletions from Joseph Smith in the text of the Bible itself. That is how much Joseph Smith's translation was seen as being a restoration of what was originally in the Bible. And Robert J. Matthews, there were a couple things that he had that were really impressive, trying to show that there were earlier manuscripts that are being reproduced in Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible. That was always the game, right? Try and find early manuscripts that Joseph Smith did not have access to that reflected his changes to whatever verses in the Bible he was changing. There were a couple that he had, and I remember what they were. But unfortunately, both of those changes end up being reflected or mentioned in the Adam Clark Bible Commentary. So the changes that Joseph Smith made were not based on manuscripts. Well, they may have been based on manuscripts that were unavailable to him, but they were based on commentaries that he had in his possession. That's the problem with them. Even the two good ones that they had fall by the wayside because of that. And so since that time, the absolute failure of the apologists for the church to find any actual evidence that the Joseph Smith translation is restoring the ancient true biblical text to its pristine form. Now they've changed their tune. Now it is no longer what it was that it was said for 150 years, 160 years. Now, because the evidence doesn't support the truth claim, they are changing it to something that is unfalsifiable. That was the word. It's unfalsifiable. The first claim is falsifiable. They falsified it. Now we got to shift to a claim that can't be falsified, and we're going to call that victory.
Yeah, thank you for buying me a moment. It took me several places to finally find a spot where I used the link with a timestamp that I could use it. For whatever reason, sometimes when we use Google Slides and insert videos, they don't want to play where they're supposed to, and this one didn't have the timestamps on it. So this should work.
But you don't ever, if you go to an LDS server, they're not going to say, all right, take out your Joseph Smith translations of the Bible and open to Matthew 5, right? That's not what's going to happen.
Right. It's kind of like, that reminds me, when you're saying that, it reminds me of like when you hear apostles in general conference giving personal like interpretations or their what they feel about scriptures. It's just like that. It's just like reading scriptures and then reading one of our apostles' talks from general conference side by side. That's like pretty much what it is.
It could probably be better described as Joseph Smith commentary on the Bible. It's essentially like having Joseph Smith
in
your elbows.
And that's what some BYU professors call it.
Right.
Joseph Smith's commentary.
Which is cool.
Because translation, it just has a weird, like, people don't think. They think from one language to another.
Yeah. We know he went from Genesis.
People don't think. They actually think translation means what it means.
Yeah. And if you didn't think that was crystal clear what they were trying to say, here they say it again.
You should obviously really appreciate what Joseph Smith gave us with the Joseph Smith translations, but remember, it's not canonized for a reason. A lot of it really is just Joseph Smith's commentary, his notes, his thoughts. It's like reading his study journal that he was keeping as he was reading the Bible, which we should definitely reference it. We should definitely read it. But remember, it's not canonized. So it's not technically scripture, and we don't know if he like fully completed it.
There are some times where he'd make a note or whatever, and he'd kind of look at it and he'd be like, I probably could have written this a little better if I spent more time on it, but it's sufficient for my needs right now.
Is that the Mormonism? Is that the Joseph Smith translation you were raised with?
No, not at all. This is a total recasting of the truth claim that's been disproven in trying to make it unfalsifiable. By the way, the young lady over here on the right, if you can go to the beginning of that clip, I just want to say something that I learned from watching.
The first clip we played?
This clip. It's okay. The first part of this clip when she's speaking. I just, before you play it, I just want to repeat the line. And I can't, who is it? The main guy, Sean.
You talking about the person on the left here?
No, in Game of Thrones.
Oh, I don't know.
Or is
Lannister.
No, this was, Stark. Eddard Stark, whatever. Anyway, so he's hanging out with the king. They're friends from way back. Anyway, they're just having a discussion. And he mentions to him, he says, everything that comes before the word but in a sentence is bullshit.
Oh, gotcha. I can just refresh this and it'll play again.
Yeah, it's a great way to...
You should obviously really appreciate what Joseph Smith gave us with the Joseph Smith translations, but remember, it's not canonized for a reason.
But
it really is just Joseph Smith's commentary.
It's just Joseph Smith's commentary. You don't really have to pay that much attention to it. It's like when prophets get up and share their opinions in conference.
Exactly. And the church only went to all that effort to include it in their version of the Bible in footnotes, as well as in the appendix for longer pieces. And by the way, I'll just let you in on a little secret here that I think you already know, Bill. The Book of Moses is the first seven chapters of the Joseph Smith translation.
Yeah, you can't get away from it.
No, it's in the Pearl of Great Price. It's canonized.
They don't want to deal with that, though.
Joseph Smith Matthew in the Pearl of Great Price is Joseph Smith translation of Matthew 24. It's canonized. You can't get away from that. Did they bring either of those up?
No, they don't. They didn't bring either one of those up. Folks, if you're young, if you're in your 20s, maybe even early 30s, you sort of go like, yeah, I don't remember hearing much about this. But I'm telling you, being in the church as a really young adult, older teenager, RFM joined in 1978, correct?
Yes.
So we both, along with everyone who was in the church at that time, we all were raised with a story that the Joseph Smith translation, as you put it, RFM, is a restoration. The Bible had been corrupted by corrupt priests, by other villainous people who had manipulated the scriptures, taken things out, added things in, changed things. And Joseph Smith was doing the holy duty of taking the Bible and restoring it back to its ancient form. The problem, as Thomas Wayman points out in the Rick Bennett interview, is there is a whole host of problems with that. It is obvious that Joseph Smith is borrowing from Adam Clark's commentary, and that much of what he does to the Bible reflects 19th century ideas going on and has nothing to do with restoring it. And Wayman, most importantly, points to the ancient documents of the Bible and says whatever Joseph was doing, he wasn't getting it closer to the original manuscripts.
Can I bring up a thought that's not mine, but it's a very good thought, and I wanted to share it right now. Mm-hmm. I was speaking with a friend of mine the other day, and he was telling me, you know, the Book of Mormon does a really good job of addressing issues in the early 19th century United States. It addresses issues all over the place, infant baptism, all this stuff. The Book of Mormon, which is supposed to be written for our day as well, doesn't address any of the issues that are important to our day.
Not a single one.
Right. And that alone, I thought, was an excellent observation and should and could lead one to certain conclusions.
Yes. Okay, so the Joseph Smith translation, by turning it from something it was supposed to be, the restored Bible, which can be fact-checked, turns it into a flawed Bible commentary, which makes it indiscernible from a fraud. You'll have fun with this next one, RFM. Let me get rid of that screen and go to this one. This is the DNA issue with the Book of Mormon. When DNA research is done on Native Americans and Polynesians and others, what we discover is that those folks are almost entirely, and even in the parts that aren't, those are explained otherwise, but they are almost entirely tied to Asia and Asian DNA. These are Asian people who came across the land bridge and through evolution became Native Americans, right? And when that DNA research came out, it squashed the idea that the church used to hold, which is on the top right there, all were destroyed except the Lamanites, and they are the principal ancestors of the American Indians. Now, that claim could be proven false by today's science.
And it was in writing, and it was in the Book of Mormon introduction, which was approved. Can I just tell you, it was approved by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. Come on, you think an introduction to the Book of Mormon isn't going to have to be approved at the top levels?
Yeah. And because science disproved the claim, the church just said, well, that's fine. We'll just make a different claim. Now our claim is that all were destroyed except the Lamanites. And they are among the ancestors of the American Indians, which no matter how little DNA you find, and we'll get to another example later that shows that, no matter how little DNA you find, and you find none, there are claims that you find it, but the geneticists point to that DNA entering Native American genetics at the wrong time, the wrong place. It doesn't fit.
Well, after Columbus, yeah.
Yes, but even if you don't find it, it doesn't matter. All we need is one person to be a Nephite or a Lamanite and the rest to be Asians, and we can explain it away. It makes Lamanite DNA or Native American DNA being compared to what we would expect indiscernible from a fraud. Any thoughts here?
Yeah, unless you have taken the DNA of every single last person in both North and South America and the Isles of the Sea, and probably anywhere else for good measure, unless you've taken all their DNA and found that they are not from the Near East, then guess what? You can't disprove the second statement. The first statement's already been disproven. That's why it was changed to the really unfalsifiable second statement. It's like the Hill Cumorah. Until every single hill in North and South America has been investigated and dug up and found to be clean of all these millions of skeletons, then it's still unfalsifiable because it could happen sometime in the future.
Yeah, but the church cut its legs out from under itself in doing this, and for a couple of reasons. One, you'll notice in the bottom left-hand corner, the angel Moroni, told me of a sacred record which was written upon the plates of gold. I saw in vision the place where they were deposited. He said the Indians were the literal descendants of Abraham. Now, again, you can say that doesn't necessarily have to mean principle. Well, it sure seems to indicate some sort of significance, not just a couple of Jews among all the Asians.
Well, Moroni didn't know what he was talking about either.
Yeah, except he's a resurrected being when he says it. But hey, no big deal.
In the scriptures, the Doctrine and Covenants say that the Lamanites, borders of the Lamanites, Missouri, that's where you're going to build Zion, over by the borders of the Lamanites. They're right there. They are the Native Americans who are over there on the other side of the river from Jackson County. Those are the borders of the Lamanites.
Yeah. The other quote, if there had been large numbers of other peoples here when the Jaredites came or when Lehi arrived, certainly the Book of Mormon would have said so. This is Mark Peterson, by the way, former apostle. The land was reserved for the Lord's purpose and for his people, for his peoples, and the Book of Mormon provides their histories. And it does another thing too, which is who's the primary audience for which the Book of Mormon was written for?
I think Lamanites. It's also got Gentiles and Jews in there, but I think mainly Lamanites. The entire arc of the Book of Mormon, you know, I've been studying it very in depth this year. The entire arc of the Book of Mormon is it recognizes the Lamanites are going to become apostate, but they're going to kill all the Nephites. But they are keeping this record for one reason and one reason only. This is the Book of Mormon itself, not the title page. The entire Book of Mormon says this is done for this reason, so that we can bring the Lamanites back to a knowledge of the covenants of their fathers. They can be gathered in and be brought to a restoration in the last days.
Yes. So when on one hand, your claim is that your sacred text was primarily written to convert the Lamanites back to the gospel, and then the second claim is now that you cannot pinpoint any Lamanite. If I line up 100 Mexicans, Native Americans, and Polynesians and ask you to point out which ones are Lamanites, could anybody in the church do that today?
I think that by this point, they realize that they would be taking a risk in doing so.
Yeah, because now you don't know who's a Lamanite and who isn't. Tan skin is no longer the indicator. And so how do you give a book that's been written to a specific people to a people that you can't distinguish from anyone else?
Well, just give the book to all of them and let God sort it out.
Indiscernible from a fraud, folks. All right. Bottleneck and genetic drift. This is also playing into Book of Mormon DNA. Any thoughts here?
Well, if you don't know what population bottleneck and genetic drift are, these are actual things that happen with DNA that the apologists latch onto in order to try and explain why it is that there's no DNA that supports the Book of Mormon origin story for the Lamanites, for the Native American Indians, which is coming from the Middle East. So that is the entire origin story in the Book of Mormon, and yet it's not there. So now, because of that, the apologists don't say, well, I guess the Book of Mormon is a 19th century production. No, it's still history. How can we make it still history? By coming up with excuses for why it is that the DNA does not support the Book of Mormon narrative. And there it is. The difficulties do not end with the founder effect. You see, there's all sorts of different things, different effects in DNA that they want to marshal in order to account for this stunning lack of evidence. Even if it were known with a high degree of certainty that the immigrants described in the Book of Mormon had what might be considered typically Near Eastern DNA, which is what we would expect, it is quite possible, here comes the lie,
it is quite possible
that their DNA markers did not survive the intervening centuries. Well, how did that happen? Principles well known to scientists, including population bottleneck and genetic drift, often lead to the loss of genetic markers or make those markers nearly impossible to detect, even among a civilization that is described in the Book of Mormon in the hundreds of thousands. And here I'm just talking about the Nephites and the Lamanites, not the Jaredites.
Yeah. Compare that to Mark. Say that again.
Because they probably came from Asia.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, if you can move the hill Cumorah, you can move Jerusalem too, couldn't you?
That was the line. Thank you. At least the brethren are showing that they do have the faith to move mountains. Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that one.
Oh, goodness gracious. And
but compare these are real things that happen, right?
Yes.
But what they're doing is, once again, they're making the Book of Mormon indistinguishable from a fraud. They went from a falsifiable claim, which then got falsified. So they retreated to an unfalsifiable claim.
Yeah. And you compare that to Mark E. Peterson's quote, "If there had been large numbers of other peoples here when the Jaredites came or when Lehi arrived, certainly the Book of Mormon would have said so."
I just made that point in another podcast. Of course they would make, I mean, they mention it when they run into the Jaredites, or the one Jaredite who remains. They mention it when they run into the Mulekites, right? Every time they run into somebody who they don't know, of course they're putting it in the record. That's big news in these parts.
But in this case, there are millions of people and only a small band of Lamanites and Nephites,
yes,
and not a single whisper.
I thought you were going to write that down, Bill.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, I can use the catalyst theory and do that.
I know, and you thought I was going to write it down. And guess what? It didn't get written down. Sorry.
It was on the
160. If there be mistakes, Bill, if there be mistakes, they are the errors of men.
Yeah. It's on the 116 pages, folk. Or it's in the sealed portion. We'll find it someday.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Allowing tight and loose translation methods. You mentioned this. There are issues with the Book of Mormon. Again, when we're told about the translation, RFM, you and I were raised with the story that Joseph Smith used the Nephite spectacles. He was given one word at a time, would spell it out, and only when it was spelled correctly would they move on to the next word.
Yeah, for proper names, he would spell them out. Right.
Yep.
Right. And he would give a sentence of some words. He would stop, scribe, write it down. Scribe has to read it back to him. If it's not correct, Joseph Smith corrects it until the scribe has it right, the way it's looking in the spectacles. Yep. And when the scribe had it written down correctly, then he could go on and continue translating. That is as tight a translation description as you could possibly have.
Yep. And the apologists play on that. They'll say things like Lehi and Nephi are Egyptian sort of names, and hence they come to this place as Jews, but who know Reformed Egyptian. They have some sort of connection to Egypt and that culture. Hence, it's an evidence of the Book of Mormon. Nahum requires a tight translation, right?
Yes.
So these kinds of ideas require a tight translation, but there are also problems with the tight translation. So when they speak of horses or chariots or elephants, various vegetables or whatever, not vegetables, or crops that they would grow, you run into problems with the Book of Mormon as well. And so in those instances, they use a loose translation. And by allowing both to occur, again, God is so painstakingly concerned with the geographic locations of Mahanri and Moriankomer, which are in the chapter, which is who Mahanri Moriankomer is named after, are these places in the Book of Mormon that carry those two names split apart. He's so concerned with those geographic location names that he spells them letter by letter and gets it right. And in other instances, he allows Joseph Smith to put in whatever he wants as a substitute for anything. And when you allow for both and recognize how irrational that is, considering the process, what you come to realize is that the reason we have tight and loose translation and advocate for both at various places in the Book of Mormon is because it allows you to then make your claims without them being falsifiable. They are now, as you said, unfalsifiable claims and indiscernible from a fraud.
Yeah, let me go ahead and state what you said in a different way, which is simply this, that if you're using the tight translation, the text of the Book of Mormon has issues in it that are highly problematic with the tight translation and tend to prove that it is not genuine. So we come up with the loose translation, but the loose translation has problems with it that also tend to make the Book of Mormon look like it's not original, like it's not authentic, and it has to be saved by the tight translation. So it's like you're in the ring and you are wrestling. You're one person, but you're wrestling against a team, and they tag team. When you've got the tight translation down on the mat, he tags out to loose translation, and loose translation comes in, and you got to fight this person.
Yeah, I was having memories there of the Junkyard Dog and Jimmy Snuka, but we'll move on. Okay.
Okay.
All right, faith. This is one of your favorites. You did an episode on this a while back. Oh, yeah. Faith not to be healed.
Look at that guy. You know, it's amazing. I'm just a picture of him. He's remarkable. It's like Elder Bednar, a man barely alive.
Mr. Susan Bednar.
We can rebuild him. We have the technology. Okay, I know, he says, in 2013, I know you have the faith to be healed, but do you have the faith not to be healed? I mean, isn't this like, who's the guy? I'm sorry, the guy in the Young Men's Presidency who gave that ridiculous talk about the question we should be asking.
Brad Wilcox.
Isn't this a Brad Wilcox-ism? Didn't Elder Bednar do Brad Wilcox before Brad Wilcox was cool? You know, we've been asking, do you have the faith to be healed? What we should be asking is, do you have the faith not to be healed?
Yeah. And you look at various health statistics in Utah, it's never number one. It's somewhere usually towards the middle. It's better in some categories. It's worse than others. But if priesthood power is real and Utah has a more significant access to God's holy power to give blessings, then what you should expect to find in the data is that people, the health statistics in Utah should be significantly, even if they're offset by all of us apostates having a drink on the weekends or doing carrying out our mischief, we should still see a significant increase in the health of Latter-day Saints or the Mormon population in Utah. We don't find that. I know they live a little longer and all that stuff, but we don't see eyesight being restored. We don't see missing fingers coming back. Nobody's got their chopped off ear put back on. And in several categories, it isn't near the top. It's often, again, towards the middle, maybe in the higher third or lower third in various places. But what seems obvious is that priesthood power isn't real. And I once suggested you could take a Catholic priest, a set of Mormon elders, and an atheist, and you could send them down three different wings randomly of a hospital, have them give some sort of their ritual. The atheist could just snap their fingers and say, you know, be healed or whatever. And what you would find is that the data would show that no one's having any greater effect than any other. And at some point, I think David Bednar realized that we're not really that good at healing people. So we'll just make faith not to be healed the greater of the two faiths.
I know. How lame. But you know something? Because faith to be healed is falsifiable, as you just demonstrated. Faith not to be healed is unfalsifiable. It's the same kind of thing. By the way, do you know why Elder Bednar has to be careful not to get caught in the rain?
He'll melt?
No, he'll rust is the problem. In fact, right here, I think what he's saying is...
Oil can.
He does look a little bit like the Tin Man, doesn't he?
Yes, that or Terminator Jr.
Yeah. All right. Faith not to be healed. Okay. Wow, RFM. This? Racist doctrines into racist theories.
Right. That's an old one, isn't it? Doctrines become theories, whether it's Adam God, which was the Adam God doctrine, which you had to believe in order to go to the celestial kingdom and avoid eternal damnation. You had to believe it was true according to Brigham Young. It's doctrine, baby, doctrine. But once it goes by the wayside, doctrines become theories and sometimes just policies. So there's Lowry Nelson. And Dr. Lowry Nelson, who I think most people have heard of, he was an individual who was in correspondence. He was tapped to go scout out. Was it Cuba or... So I think it was Cuba, as a place for missionary work. And he found out that there was a great deal of intermixture of African-American blood there. And so there was this correspondence going back and forth where he said, yeah, this would be a great place. And the church leaders are saying, it's right after World War II. It's like 1947, I think. And the church leaders going, yeah, that doesn't look good because, you know, we got problems with the priesthood and they can't get the priesthood. And Lowry Nelson's like going, are you serious? Really? We can't do missionary work here because they can't have the priesthood? And it was like it was a big surprise to him. He couldn't imagine that the First Presidency was actually being serious in backing this idea, this doctrine, and that they're basing church decisions about missionary work, who can hear the gospel, who can't hear the gospel, based upon this doctrine. Now, I do happen to have a pet theory that it was Lowry Nelson and this correspondence that was directly responsible. This is a theory, by the way, not doctrine. Directly responsible for the issuance of the First Presidency Statement in 1949, declaring that the priesthood and temple ban on black people was not a policy. It says that. It's not a policy. This is doctrine. And I think right. that was probably issued as a response to Larry Nelson to make sure he understood that now that we put it in writing and all signed our names to it and it's official First Presidency statement, now you can believe it.
Yeah. And if you're a believer and you're raised with this being a doctrine, and there are certain teachings around it. Brigham Young said that people of color won't get the priesthood until all the white people have gotten it. So sometime in or after the millennium. And it also calls you, if you finally come to the realization that it was made up, then you have to now deal with how trustable prophets are. And the leaders don't want you not trusting them. Modern prophets always trump dead prophets. So by turning the doctrines of the past into the disavowed theories of the present, what you do is you make it so that believers can no longer look at the past teaching and go, that was false doctrine taught by true prophets. Let me sit with that for a minute. Wait a minute. False doctrine taught by true prophets. Wait a minute. False prophets teach false doctrine. True prophets teach true doctrine. But by making it disavowed theories, you just have them speaking as a man, right? A prophet is only a prophet when acting as such. And there are times where he is speaking only as a man. And that was these instances, even though at the time, these men were sure as hell that they were right and that these were the doctrines established from Brigham Young forward and had the stamp of approval from God. How come these guys couldn't get answers? How come God couldn't tell them they were wrong? How come they weren't listening? If they weren't listening on this issue, which seems monumentally important to prevent a segment of human beings from being marginalized and shamed for no reason at all, it seems like on all the mundane issues, maybe they weren't listening very well either.
What? Right. Well, cross-reference everything that you said with something that President Nelson, the living prophet, said a couple of years ago, which is that prophets teach the truth.
Yeah. Only the truth.
That's all they do. It's their job description. So it is a house of cards, and I don't know. Do they expect people to not put two and two together on this and to not ask questions? I think that they have been very fortunate in that regard. The church has for many, many, many decades. But now since 2010, the last 15 years, since 2009, I think that a strong wind has started blowing and that house of cards is beginning to tumble.
Yeah. So doctrines into theories helps to make Mormonism indiscernible from a fraud.
Yeah. And the strong wind would be, of course, the internet.
Yeah. Speak for a moment about the endowment, separating the endowment and what modern apologetics does is says, well, there's this underlying thing that is the endowment, but what you're picking apart as masonry or the things that we've changed, that's the presentation of the endowment. That's a different thing.
Yeah, I've heard this. Now, first off, let's be clear that the endowment itself was a revelation, a very special revelation that was given to Joseph Smith, which he set forth and began instituting among the saints in his lifetime. It was handed off to Brigham Young, and Brigham Young did what he did with it. And so it's something that has been in the temple. Now, it has been changed a number of times. But the problem is that it was not supposed to be changed because it came from God. God usually does things right the first time. That's why he's called God. But it's been changed over and over again. And the common apologetic for this now that has arisen, it's not something Joseph Smith talked about, to my knowledge, or anybody in the first, 100 years of Mormonism. But now they're trying to say, well, the endowment is one thing, but the presentation of the endowment is another thing. So it's like everything that you experience in the temple is the way the endowment is presented, and that can be changed. It's like doctrine of policy, right? That can be changed. But there are these fundamental kernels of the endowment that cannot be changed. And I think that up to now, they would usually say that those are the covenants that one makes in the temple, the four or five different specific covenants that one makes. And everything else and all the drama that goes on around it with Adam and Eve and Elohim and Jehovah and Michael and Lucifer, and it used to be the Protestant minister was in there too. All those things are just the vehicle through which the covenants are transported, are received by people, and are taught. I don't know that it's that easy. I think that's a bad argument, but it's, you know, it's the only game in town, right? Because it has been changed. And Joseph Smith did say at one point that it wasn't going to be changed. It's from God. So we'll change it. We'll make it the presentation of the endowment versus this underlying endowment itself, which is, like I said, the covenants. What do you do now? What do they do now that the covenants themselves are being altered?
Yeah, the two things we run into is that it's absolutely just agreed upon by all sides at this point that Joseph Smith took much of the endowment from Masonry. And originally when he did it, he was able to present a story to the early leaders. We have quotes from Heber C. Kimball and Wilford Woodruff and others, where they say that the original endowment given to Joseph Smith, again, like the JST, was a corrected form of a corrupted endowment that the Masons were using. And we have quotes from, again, multiple leaders who say that Joseph Smith taught that.
It was celestial masonry.
Yep. But when historians get into masonry, what they find out is that it actually begins, I think, in the between the 13 and 1700s, but doesn't go any further back than that.
Yeah, we can say the Middle Ages. It does not go back to Solomon, and God help us, it does not go back to Adam.
No. And so by showing that, hey, he actually took something that was invented as a modern thing, and it's not a corrupted form of an ancient endowment, that's its own problem. And then as you pointed to, Joseph Smith said, the prophet Joseph Smith taught, his quote, this is his words, ordinances instituted in the heavens before the foundation of the world in the priesthood for the salvation of men are not to be altered or changed. And what have Mormon leaders done since Joseph Smith? Changed the temple ordinance over and over and over again, even to the point where even if you were really lenient on what that could mean, you'd have to agree that women no longer promise obedience to their husbands. No one promises not to laugh loud. So the actual ordinances themselves have changed because here's the last sentence of the quote, all must be saved on the same principles. And if one person promises obedience to God and another person promises obedience to their husband, or one person promises not to laugh loud and another doesn't make the promise, then are people being saved on the same principles? And no, they're not. That's not true. So the ordinances have changed. And so the fact that masonry is problematic, the fact that the changes are problematic, you get to say there is this invisible fluffy thing underneath that stayed the same, but everything that you can test and try and look at the results of, anything that's falsifiable, that's the presentation of the endowment, hence making it indiscernible from a fraud.
Yeah, and I think what's likely is that Joseph Smith, who did have some familiarity with masonry, did believe what was taught by the Masons, that it did go back to the Temple of Solomon. And so what would be more natural to his mind to use it and then present it in the temple, because he's restoring the ancient temple rite, which is what masonry presented itself as being. He's going to change it around some. He's going to keep a lot of the signs and the tokens. And then everything's fine. Everything's good until we find out that actually the Masonic tradition is wrong. In fact, it's grossly wrong. Not only does it not go back to Solomon's temple, it doesn't go back earlier than the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
That's the problem, I think, that Joseph Smith had, because he didn't realize that at the time. He thought it went back to the Temple of Solomon. And this goes back to a scripture that was very, very important back in 1978 when I joined the church, talking about the apostasy. It's Isaiah chapter 24, verses 5 and 6. This may sound familiar to you, and I'm just going to read verse 5. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. Why? Three reasons. Because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, and broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. Well, I don't know anybody who's changed the ordinances more than the LDS Church has, so it sounds like that scripture, which is an apostasy scripture, applies to the LDS Church.
Yeah, they did. They broke the other two too. You said, read those again.
Transgress the laws.
They transgress the laws. Let me give an example. Doctrine and Covenants says that every person in disciplinary court at the stake level has a right to 12 people in the room. The church has come out and said, we're just going to ignore that. And now it only may require, all we require is the stake presidency to be in the room. The stake president gets to decide if those 12. That is transgressing the law that God gave in the Doctrine and Covenants. Okay, we talked about the ordinances. What was the third one?
Broken the everlasting covenant.
Yeah, and if you remember what the everlasting covenant was, the new and everlasting covenant, celestial marriage, eternal polygamy, immortality as well, and that was required for exaltation, and the church just changed that to eternal marriage. So it has broken that one as well. And then I just want to note one last thing. This used to be this presentation of the endowment apologetic used to just be an apologetic outside the church. I just want to note in the bottom right-hand corner of that slide, this is the current animated video the church has on Joseph Smith and Masonry, and this is what they say. The temple ceremony was not an imitation or copy of Masonry. It was a revelation from God. Yes, the presentation methods may have parallels to Masonic ritual, but the content of the instruction, the covenants, and truths introduced by Joseph Smith as part of the endowment were revealed to him prior to his encounter with Masonry. And I just want to note, by the church's own standard, it would have to admit that it has changed the very covenants and truths that are underlying this ritual as well. So it has broken and changed the ordinances and no longer are all saved on the same principles.
Great commentary, Bill.
Okay. Next, turning gold plates into tumbaga plates. Talk about this one, Arvin.
Tumbaga. This is back in the 1980s when we're all learning about tumbaga as the Mormon apologists. And we're going, wow, tumbaga is going to save the day. Because the problem with these gold plates is if they're really gold, they're way too heavy for Joseph Smith to have been carrying around. I mean, poor Moroni having to carry him from Mesoamerica all the way up to New York via Manti in Utah. So we've got to make things easier because that just doesn't sound plausible for Joseph Smith or Moroni. We need lighter plates. So fortunately, there is another metal which has gold in it, but it also has lighter alloys in it. And it's called tumbaga. And I think that, was it used? I think it was used in Mesoamerica or somewhere in the Americas. And so therefore there's a connection. So it's got to be tumbaga because if it's tumbaga, then it's going to weigh less than it would if it were solid gold. And Joseph Smith is not going to have to get a hernia carrying it home from the hill. He's also going to be telling a story that is now, it's really not that much more believable. It's still freaking heavy, but it's not completely impossibly heavy if it's tumbaga instead of gold. So the Mormon apologists, me included, were great advocates for tumbaga.
Yeah. And you see Book of Mormon Central there in the bottom left, plates of tumbaga make a lot of sense for several reasons. And by the way, notice what they're admitting about what gold, how gold would be problematic, because this is important. Gold is too soft and thin. Gold plates would not hold up well. The copper makes tumbaga more rigid and resilient, even in thin sheets.
Yeah, I think you may put a comment there, and thin gold plates would not hold up well.
Yeah. Yeah. Moreover, the thin gold surface that appears after the gilding process, in other words, you have to do an extra process to tumbaga to make it appear gold, would have made the plates easy to engrave and would have also protected the surface from rust and corrosion.
Can I just break in here? I apologize, Bill. This stuff now just drives me crazy because what they're saying is, okay, it's not gold. It's something else that wasn't gold. You know, it's something else in spite of what? Oh, go ahead. You read verse 34 there and then I'll make
a comment. Well, let me start with something else first. The top left, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on its website. Here's what it says. It's talking about the fact that people have a problem with gold. It says, with rumors swirling around about the plates, Joseph sought to set the record straight by publishing official statements in the first edition of the Book of Mormon. Joseph's preface and testimonial written by a group of eight witnesses described the plates as having an appearance of gold.
There you go.
The Book of Mormon authors simply said that they engraved their writings on plates.
There you go.
So the church is claiming that no Book of Mormon author claimed that the plates were gold. And therefore, you shouldn't expect the plates to be gold. But as you point out, RFM, Joseph Smith history, chapter 1, verse 34, what does Joseph Smith say he was told by one of the authors of the plates? He said,
Moroni said, there was a book deposited written upon gold plates. Damn it, Moroni.
Damn it. If Moroni just wouldn't have said that. Now, what you end up having then is the church is either ill-informed, which is sort of ridiculous, or their intention. What's that?
It's ridiculous or redundant.
And or they're intentionally ignoring it and misleading the audience. And I'll leave you to guess which one's probably happening.
But you see, gold is not just a metal. It's also a color, Bill.
It is. But it does seem weird that Moroni is making a big deal out of the color of the plates, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I got to tell you. And, you know, why is it that everybody
wants... He's my favorite color, Nephi. You know, what is that? Like, I don't understand that.
All these people want to get the plates from Joseph Smith. They're breaking in. They're busting up the hearth and everything because they want their Tumbaga, damn it.
Yeah.
It's not because it's gold. But this is the whole thing about Tumbaga. It reminds me of the joke about the guy who's walking along the street and he sees some other guy who's down on his hands and knees in the middle of the street. He's obviously looking for something. And he says, did you lose something? And the guy says, yeah, I lost a quarter. And the guy says, well, where'd you lose it? And he says, up the street a block. And he says, so why are you looking at it here? Looking here. He says, well, the light's much better here.
Wasn't it two quarters to see the monkey in the box?
Oh my gosh. Are you back on the monkey in the box? I'm trying to make a point with my joke. The joke is, that's okay. The joke is, it doesn't make any difference where you lose the quarter up there, a block away. Go look where the light's better, even though the quarter's not going to be there.
You're never going to find it, but at least you can see what is there.
Yeah. So they're looking for that, those gold plates, you know, like a block away in Tumbaga City.
Yeah. And again, by making the plates not have to be gold, even in spite of the fact that Moroni said they were, you then make the weight of the plates not a claim that would bother you. And hence, Mormonism is no longer discernible as a fraud. So indiscernible. Hmm. All right. Garments aren't magical.
They were in 1978. That's all I can say.
They absolutely were. In fact, in the old handbook, and I think they might even say this still, and I did hear when they had the two talks on garments, by the way, they still use the word protect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I want to know. Actually,
I think Elder Oak says they don't protect. He used it in a term to discount the idea of protection.
Yeah, but what's the handbook here say from, I don't know what year this was, but this is an older handbook. It says, when properly worn, will serve as a protection against temptation and evil. Now, I want you to think about this. What if you, the only way it makes sense that if they're properly worn, properly worn is an important part of that comment, because somebody could accidentally improperly wear them and they would lose the protection. But if the protection isn't supernatural magic, that makes no sense. Properly wearing them is like casting the spell the right way. It's like Joseph Smith, the treasure digger, drawing the circle correctly. It's like making sure he's got the parchment with him, the magic parchment, and he says the spell correctly. When the garment is properly worn, it will serve as a protection against temptation and evil. And then today the church says some people incorrectly refer to the temple garments as magical or magical underwear, magic underwear. These words are not only inaccurate, but are also offensive to members of the church. By the way you make something untalkable or unstatable is make it offensive. To the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there is nothing magical or mystical about temple garments. The other problem with that is that Boyd K. Packer, we talked about this before, Boyd K. Packer shared the talk from, what's the gentleman's name who talked about his boat being on fire and he caught on fire? And
Marriott. Was it Willard?
Yeah. Brother Marriott, the owner of the Marriott Hotels.
But was Willard I can't remember.
I don't remember his first name. Was
the son or grandson of the guy with the hotels who started him, I should say.
Yeah. So not only did a member of the church tell stories about being magically protected, and I've heard numerous stories over the course of my time in the church of people being magically protected, but Boyd K. Packer came to a regional conference and retold that story at an event I was at and claimed that the garments were magical protection. The idea that they're not magical and they don't protect you in that way is a recent invention by the LDS church. Mm-hmm. And the reason they've done it is because garments magically protecting you is a claim that could be researched and studied and shown to be falsifiable. And hence the church has reduced it to something that is indiscernible from a fraud.
Yeah. I remember hanging out with the guys, 18, 19, talking about garments. I found out about garments, within a month of my going on a mission, I think. And it was quite a surprise to me, but I'm hearing all of these stories about how they protect you. And the specific story I remember hearing was of a United States Air Force pilot in the Vietnam War who got shot down and killed. But when they found his body, he's a Mormon, by the way, duh. And he was wearing garments too. But when they found his body, it was burned on his body below the garments on the legs and on the arms and face. But the part of his body that was wearing the garments wasn't burned at all. And I'm not sure if I had the wherewithal to ask my friends, but he was still dead, right?
Like, what good did it do to not burn parts of his body that ended up not being essential to him staying alive?
Yeah, well, you know, Brando says, you live fast, you die young, you leave a good-looking corpse.
That's right. Okay. Reducing the prophetic to speaking as a man. You know, you've got this Joseph Fielding quote, which gets touted out every once in a while. You mentioned Adam God earlier. We will never get a man into space. The earth is man's sphere, and it was never intended that he should go away from it. The moon is a superior planet to the earth. I don't think he understands science, RFM.
I think he understands the Book of Abraham, chapter 3, though.
The moon is a superior planet. Yes, he does.
Because that's what he's referencing.
Yep, planet to the earth. And it was never intended that man should go there. You can write it down in your books that this will never happen. That sounds sort of prophetic.
I hope it wasn't a prophet who said that.
It was Joseph Fielding Smith. We've got revelations by Joseph Smith, which have not come to pass. There's a couple of false revelations there by Joseph. And you've got Adam God there, which was... We just now, again, Spencer Kimball and Bruce R. McConkie have reduced Adam God to just some nonsense that Brigham Young taught. It's been disavowed, and it's just weird how often true prophets, who are now dead prophets, teach false doctrines in the LDS Church.
I'm glad Joseph Fielding Smith got to live long enough to see men walk on the moon.
Yeah. Too bad Ezra Taft Benson didn't know his name at the time.
Yeah, it must have happened in a studio. Capricorn One, that whole movie, totally true.
Has to be.
Yeah, because he's a prophet.
You wonder how many Mormons maybe use this quote as evidence not to believe in the lunar landing.
Can I just say that all Mormons who don't believe in the lunar landing use this quote? They can't not use this quote.
Oh, goodness. Living prophets trump dead prophets, because if you can say the living prophet teaches the truth and dead prophets could have been wrong, then you always get to only go with what is unfalsifiable, because you can't prove it true, can't prove it false while he's saying it. It has to take the church saying later that, hey, we were wrong, before you know that the past prophet taught something wrong. So it's sort of circular logic, but it works out beautifully for the LDS Church.
At least for the living prophets. Yeah, it works out great for them. The dead prophets, we don't care about. Prophets to come, we don't care about them either. All we care about is us. And by the way, I have commented before. I will make the comment again, okay? What?
Yes.
What are you laughing
about? You're about to name the most ironic thing about this entire issue.
Oh, what? Okay. Well, I'll just go ahead and say what I was going to say, and you tell me if that's what it was.
Okay.
There's only one reason that it would ever occur to anybody, Ezra Taft Benson or anybody else, to come up with a rule like this. And that's because there are instances that he knows of where past prophets have indeed contradicted current prophets. If that never happened, you don't need this rule. You wouldn't even think of this rule. It's only because there is contradiction that this rule was made in the first place.
No, that's not a great point. That's not what I was going to say. What I was going to say is...
I'm sorry, I disappointed you. What did you think I was going to say?
I thought you were going to say, isn't it ironic that they use a dead prophet to teach that living prophets trump dead prophets? Ezra Taft Benson is long gone.
Yeah, and even by the two prophets today, I use that because apostles are prophets, seers, and revelators. Even the two prophets today who have defined doctrine as being what is said by all 15... speaking with the United Voice, this particular doctrine still hasn't qualified as doctrine under that definition. Of course, the definition doesn't qualify as doctrine either, because it's only been said by two apostles and not by all 15.
Right.
And then when you think about this long enough, you can actually go crazy.
Yeah, I start getting steam out of your ears. Neil Anderson said that all 15 men have to teach it for it to be true. And then I kind of think, like, what could we actually find all 15 men to have taught on? I mean, it's not going to be homosexuality. That's Elder Oaks. So whatever views on homosexuality we claim are the true views, I haven't heard out of the mouths of all 15. And hence, what have I heard? You know, Jesus is the Messiah. Book of Mormon's the Word of God.
Everything Repent. That's in the family proclamation. Except Maybe. You've got about, I don't know, are there only like four? How many are living today who signed that? Elder Oaks gave a talk about it a few years ago, commenting that there aren't that many alive who signed it back in 1995.
There's so one less recently.
Don't we have a majority of dead prophets who signed that thing?
Yeah.
I don't think it's binding on us anymore then.
Also ironic is that eventually all living prophets are dead prophets.
That's what I hear. I'm not sure I believe it with President Nelson, though.
He might live to be 113.
He is going
to
bury all of us.
Oh, my goodness. I hope not. But, I mean, if he outlives Bednar, I guess that might be a plus.
You cannot outlive Bednar. He is a cyborg.
This was an interesting one. Early in church history, maybe if you, you know, why don't you take this one and tell us a little bit about how speaking in tongues worked.
The gift of tongues. Okay, so I'll just talk about this briefly. Early in church history, the gift of tongues was considered to be a legitimate gift of the Spirit. You will see it referenced in the Book of Mormon as such. In fact, in the latter chapters of 2 Nephi, it is talked about as being the way that we can know what God wants us to do is by the tongue of angels. It is given a very high status. And indeed, there are different incidents in early church history where the gift of tongues, as defined in that way, was practiced, speaking in the tongue of angels. And in fact, Joseph Smith made it a passion of his to try and figure out what the original language was, the Adamic language, which is the language of God and of angels. And he did a lot of work trying to do that. Okay, having said all that, and of course, when 1979, when I go into the MTC, yeah, screw all that. The gift of tongues is just learning a different language. You can go preach the gospel.
Yeah, and if we did a study, by the way, I bet we could find out whether missionaries or other people who take on the same instruction and have the same interactions, whether they would learn the foreign language any slower since they don't have the gift of tongues. And my guess is that you would find that both in and out of the church would learn language at the exact same pace, generally. And hence, the gift of tongues really means nothing.
Right. Well, this idea about teaching it in a different language that actually exists is generally supported by Acts 2, the day of Pentecost. But by the power of the Holy Ghost, not by studying at the MTC, suddenly the apostles are able to preach to all these different nationalities who've come to Jerusalem, these different Jews who've come from different countries speaking different languages, and they all heard it in their own tongue. Now, maybe that's them speaking the tongue, or maybe that's them talking and the Holy Ghost doing the interpreting. The text itself doesn't say. What I do know is that the gift of tongues no longer exists in the LDS church as it is described in the Book of Mormon. All it is going to the MTC and learning a language. And there's in my case, there was nothing miraculous about it. So is there anything up here that I haven't covered that I need to read? Let me see here on the left. The language training mission, that's the LTM. That's in Salt Lake City. This is pre-1978, but not by much necessarily, because they had the language training mission in Salt Lake City, and then they built the MTC in Provo. The language training mission and later missionary training centers developed language study programs that foster the spiritual gift of tongues. Where's that from?
This is from the church's website. I don't know specifically, but folks could Google that sentence. We'd find it.
This is what they're doing is they're claiming to have a spiritual gift that they don't have anymore. They have redefined it in such a way that it is unfalsifiable. All right. Young people or even older people, missionaries, go learn a different language. That is fostering the spiritual gift of tongues.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you have on the right, speaking in tongues was mentioned in Revelations to Joseph Smith as one of the many gifts of the Spirit that follow those who have faith in Jesus Christ. Yeah, I think he copied that part from Paul into the Book of Mormon. Early Latter-day Saints experienced this gift in two ways. The first, speaking of singing in an unknown language, speaking or singing in an unknown language, i.e. the tongue of angels, sometimes called glossolalia. The second way church members experienced the gift of tongues was preaching the gospel in a language foreign to the speaker, but familiar to his or her listeners. Okay. Yeah. So The gift of tongues is gone in the LDS church, but it is one gift that they pretend that they still have after having redefined it in such a way as to make it indistinguishable from what everybody else on the planet does when they're learning a different language.
And the church leaders still sort of pull one over on the members once in a while. I've seen this with President Nelson, and then there was another leader recently in the last decade who did it, but where they'll go to some conference somewhere else where the people speak in some foreign language, and they'll indicate in the church periodical that Nelson understood the language without really knowing that language. He understood what was being said. And again, I don't know what is all going on there, but with all the stories he's told about the plane crash, yeah, I wouldn't believe you, President Nelson, if you told me your plane was on fire. The Mozambique, the lady with the red hat, and there was one other story too. The
incident at Mozambique.
Yeah. So we have a record of President Nelson exaggerating or embellishing or creating out of whole cloth stories.
Oh, this is great. Look what Richard Peckjack says. Spanish speaking words are proof the gift of tongues doesn't work. Bravo. Well exactly. Done. Well said.
Ta-da. All right, let's move on from this one. Okay. You said earlier apostasy, and you named what the apostasy was.
Yes.
And what the church did is said, hey, guys, we're doing everything that was named in what the apostasy is, that we're going to need a new word for apostasy. And so now we have the word ongoing restoration, which means we can change anything and everything, and that's progress, not apostasy.
Right. Apostasy is when your church changes. Continuing revelation is when our church changes.
So enough said there. President Nelson has created an ongoing restoration. I guess I will say one more thing, which is President Hinckley, there's a quote in an interview, I don't remember if it's 60 Minutes or Time Magazine or whatever it was.
He was all over the place.
He was. But one of the things that he said was that we don't need much revelation anymore. Right. Joseph Smith and the early church leaders established the church, and every once in a while we need something.
That but was the established rule of the day when I joined the church and into the 80s and 90s when President Hinckley said that.
Yes. But when President Nelson says this is an ongoing restoration and you're just seeing the beginning, he is indicating that what President Hinckley said is now being contradicted by him. So there's that one.
Good point. Good point.
Okay, we can just
move on. The ongoing revelation announcement itself is contradicting an earlier prophet.
Yeah.
But he's dead and President Nelson is alive. So who are you going to believe?
Right. He's a dead prophet. You don't believe him. Here, this one involves people like you, RFM, blaming lawyers and investment managers. Whose fault was it that we created shell companies, that we hid our money from public view, that we called people who had plain names and no social media presence? Whose fault was it? It's those lawyers and investment managers.
Well, I can give you a million reasons to prove it was the first presidency and the presiding bishopric, because that's the amount of dollars that they were fined by the SEC for doing this.
Yeah. For believers, if your prophet, seers, and revelators were acting unethically, that's a problem. But if those leaders just happen to be trusting so-called lawyers and so-called investment managers, then you can still have faith and continue on as a faithful member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Did it ever cause you any concern that it seems like everybody and their dog can pull the wool over the eyes of these prophets?
Yeah, Mark Hoffman thought so, didn't he?
Yeah, anybody can fool these people. Yeah. All the way back to Joseph Smith and the Kinderhook plates. Yeah. You would think that being a prophet would be good for something like not being fooled by charlatans or
lawyers. Unless you're the charlatan, maybe.
Yes. Ooh, very good.
And blaming artists. Everything that you believers or ex-Mormons took away from the church thinking were true but wasn't, that Joseph Smith had the plates in front of him, he used the Nephite spectacles. Whatever images you saw in the artwork that told you the story of Mormonism, wherever that was wrong, it was the artist. It was the artist taking a unique, their own solely unique view to the artwork. But here's the problem. If that's true, how come all of the artists seem to portray the same problems? Seems like they all have the same sort of mandate of what to be painting.
Yeah. And by the way, I made a comment, I think it was Monday, about I don't see any leadership from the top 15. Leadership There are certain principles of leadership, okay? I'm not saying I'm a great leader. I'm saying I know a couple of leaders, leadership principles, okay? And one of them is, number one, you don't ask somebody else to do that you wouldn't do yourself. That is one of the bedrock principles of leadership. And we see rules for thee, but not for me, all over the place. Another thing you do is you take responsibility for your actions. You don't blame somebody else that you directed to do something. And all of these people all along the way, all the prophets and apostles, what they did was they directed the artists to paint these depictions in exactly these ways. And we all know how it goes. We've heard from artists who've submitted work to the church. They give concepts, they give sketches, and it goes through this entire process where things have to be changed. You know, you got to change this, you got to change that. Okay, go back to the drawing board, blah, blah, blah. It's this laborious process where it has to be approved by the church, which only makes sense because they're the ones who are going to be publishing it in their magazines, their manuals, hanging them up on their meeting house walls. Obviously, the church is going to be involved to a minute degree in making sure that these paintings represent what it is the church leaders want them to represent. And then it comes out 2015. They have to bring out the seer stone because people are finding out about the seer stone all over the place, thanks to the internet. So they bring the seer stone, Joseph Smith seer stone, one of them, out of the church vault where they've been hiding it for a photo op. I think it was the October Ensign. Then they put it back in there. They've known they've had this all along. They have known what's been going on all along. And they have been directing the artist to paint portraits about the translation process that they knew was not the way it was done. It was not according to history, but they did it because they didn't want the members to know about the seer stone and the hat.
And you ask, why would you not want people to know about the seer stone? It's no more anything than the Nephite spectacles. Well,
of course it is. It's crazy. One's crazy. One's really crazy. I mean, now that it's out, Bill, you know this, right? Now that it's out, this is a common apologetic trope. First off, I knew about it when I was, you know, in my mother's womb. I heard about it in Sunday school. We were taught about this all the time back in the day. Yeah, right. Not true. That's another gaslighting attempt. But the other thing that they do, Bill, is that they will say, they're just equally as crazy. So why would the church want to mislead you saying Joseph Smith did it that crazy way, when this other way is just as crazy? Because it's not just as crazy. This is an ad hoc rationalization. Look at Joseph Smith there on the left. He is reading a book the way you or I would read a book. He doesn't have the book in another room or hidden outside and have his face in a hat looking at his special stone that he used to hunt treasure with and is dictating off the words that appear in the light that emanates from the stone, in the darkness that's created by the book. Those are not equally crazy. That's right. Why the church hid it. I'm sorry, go ahead, Bill.
No. One's a magical item mentioned in the Old Testament, and the other one is a rock in the ground used for money digging. Yes. My point was twofold. One is that the Nephite spectacles were prepared for the translation process. So why in the hell isn't Joseph Smith using them? That raises a significant question. Yes. The other issue is that anytime you investigate the seer stone, you are led back to the money digging, to the scrying, to the peepstone use. And what you end up with then is Joseph Smith scamming people, telling people of fictional Spanish silver mines buried in hills that always slips further into the earth and nothing's ever discovered. And that challenges the character of the prophet. So sure, we want him not using anything and reading it like a book, or at worst, let's have him using the Nephite spectacle.
Something else that occurs to me is that in each of these representations, it is being reinforced over and over and over again that Joseph Smith had gold plates.
Yeah, right. And
the actual translation, they might be on a table, but if they're on a table nearby, they're covered with a cloth.
Yeah,
they are not apparent as they are in each of these paintings or drawings. In each of these pieces of art where you can see the plates plain as day, they were not apparent to anybody during the translation process.
Okay, let's go to the next one. changing the meaning of celestial marriage. Again, the church said that polygamy was the new and everlasting covenant. It was never going to be taken off the earth based on what Jesus Christ told John Taylor in a revelation that the church still refuses to acknowledge as legitimate and has not published. And it defined its theology and doctrine with plural marriage right in the center of it. And it had to get as far away from it as it could. So it issues the 1890 manifesto, but it doesn't really quit polygamy. It keeps it underground. Why? Because it was necessary to keep it. They couldn't get rid of it. The Wilford Woodruff was positive that, yes, we can lie to the U.S. government, but no, we can't actually extinguish polygamy. So he calls on loyal Latter-day Saints to go off to various places, Canada, Mexico, and in the United States, carry on polygamy secretly because we can't end it. God said so, only to have within a decade or two them finally end it and then redefine celestial marriage as just eternal marriage between one man and one wife, and that plural marriage immortality is no longer a thing. And now members don't even have the wherewithal to recognize that this doctrine was taught early in the church and that it has been abandoned as no longer true, even though the leaders at the time said it had to be true forever. And we did a long episode on that showing all the quotes from leaders. And so by redefining the meaning of celestial marriage, you give members the feel good of temple ceilings without any ability to question how this word's been used in the past.
Right. Change the definitions.
Yeah. And that's what high demand religions do. They often change definitions on a regular basis. And I think at least in part, it's so that any of us who are out of the church for a while, we continue to use the old vernacular, the old vocabulary. And it signals to the believer who's in, who, when the language is changed, that when we say Mormon and they say we're not Mormons, we're Latter-day Saints, it's a signal to them that we're not trustable. And so when we say home teacher and they say ministering servant, anytime you change the language, you allow the in-group to know who the out-group is. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does, absolutely. You know, and I think that this latest controversy surrounding General Relief Society President Camille Johnson's address that she gave at the BYU Women's Conference just this past Friday, I think part of the problem that this is causing is that there's a redefinition going on. Mm-hmm. Is that she had a career, she had some kids, but she also had a career as a corporate lawyer. She wasn't at home taking care of the kids as women were admonished to by President Kimball and President Ezra Taft Benson. She didn't do that. She's 60 now, so she was choosing to disobey the prophets at that time by having a career. Now, leaving aside whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, she was definitely not following prophetic counsel. But now the definition has been changed, and now she's being held up as a role model for women in the church, saying that she is actually following the prophets. And I think this is part of this gaslighting that's causing so many people to wonder what on earth is going on now in the church. Because why is it that this person who would have been considered in apostasy, how did she even get a temple recommend at the time? Other women didn't get temple recommends who went outside the home to have jobs. How did she, who was living her life in direct opposition to the words of the prophets, now being held up by the current prophet as a role model that women should follow, except for the having a career part?
It seems that the church is so desperate to change things quickly that they're willing to take the risk of disrupting members who understood the church to mean a certain thing, to do a certain thing. It's almost like they now see that collateral damage as worth the risk, where I think in decades past, change came so much slower. I think they sort of agree with Richard Bushman that the dominant narrative isn't true, and they have to hurry up and change it before people recognize it.
Yeah, they're causing all sorts of damage, untold amounts of trauma by doing this.
Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts from you? We gave 19 examples. We're really looking forward to hearing some of yours. So the call lines are open, 662-667-6667 or 662-MORMONS. Any other thoughts from you on sort of demonstrating, because I think once you see it, folks who have watched it tonight, the rest of their life as they look at Mormonism will quickly realize what it means to reduce an issue that's problematic, to reframe it in a way that makes it indiscernible from a fraud.
Right.
Any thoughts?
And when you have a church that on 19 different occasions has reframed their truth claims to something that's not able to be falsified, that is indiscernible from a fraud, it is reasonable at that point to conclude that it is a fraud.
Ding, ding, ding.
If it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's probably a duck.
And if Mormonism really were the true and living church upon the earth, which with which the Lord was well pleased, it seems like on these 19 issues and whatever other ones are out there, that we should have just expected it to add up the way we were originally told it should have added up.
Mm-hmm.
That the writings of Abraham written upon his own hand would have turned out to be, in fact, the writings of Abraham written upon his own hand.
Yeah.
The celestial marriage or plural marriage would have simply stuck around and not gone away. That John Taylor being visited by Jesus Christ would have meant something. That the gold plates would have been gold. That there would have been an explanation for that. That it would have been a tight translation. And that the expansion theory wouldn't be needed. But that's not the case. It's only when truth claims don't add up that you have to amend your truth claims.
And I suppose looking at it from a different angle about the plates, if Joseph Smith really had possession of that amount of gold in the form of plates, he would not have made the mistake of talking about running home with them and fighting off attackers while holding them onto the plates, because he would have known he couldn't have done that, which does suggest that Joseph Smith never had any experience with gold plates.
Amen. Well, Tumbaga, if you make the plates so thin and they're creased and there's so much air in between them and you account for the holes where the rings are out, and if you just make allowances here and allowances there, all of a sudden they're just barely light enough that you can carry them.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was very, very strong.
Strong young man.
It was like the Hulk coming home from the hill.
All right. I've got a couple of calls on the line, so let me turn on that. And I believe this is, it says Tim Andy. Could you turn off your monitor or TV or whatever you're watching that on? And is it Tim or Andy?
Tim.
Tim, go ahead, my friend. You're on Mormonism Live.
Hi. This isn't Mormon specific, but the atonement of Jesus is a perfect example of what you're talking about. Jesus was supposed to be a physical Messiah that would do something tangible to save the Jews. And when that didn't work out so well, they just changed it to a spiritual type of salvation that's completely untestable and indistinguishable from a fraud. And now guess what the symbol of Christianity is? It's the cross, the very symbol of the failure that occurred in the first place.
Mm. I appreciate that.
Good point. And, you know, that makes me also think that every time that Jesus' second coming is predicted, April 8th, and then he doesn't show up, it always has to be changed. I mean, that's so obvious. It almost shouldn't even have to be mentioned, but I'm going to mention it anyway and add it to the list.
And I just want to say, President Clinton, thank you very much. Thank you for the call. I thought it sounded like him. I thought it sounded... Talk for a moment. Tim, talk for a second.
Hey, I feel your pain. Can you say that for us?
Good enough. Thank you.
Good enough.
Love the show.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh. That does sound like Bill Clinton now that you mentioned it.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Jesus did not make a literal atonement for people. He's right, though. Jesus, the Messiah, was supposed to come rescue the Jews out of bondage. And instead, he just reanimates after 3 days and nobody's seen it really happen. So Mark ends his chapter early.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm getting the story off here.
All right. Let's go next. Okay. I don't have a name. What's the name, caller?
Kimona.
Kimona, go ahead. You're on Mormonism Live.
Well, I want you to give you three examples, two of discrepancies. Then it's kind of sad. When I joined the church in 1980, I never was told that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy.
Yeah, no one was told.
They didn't tell you that either?
No.
Just you and RFM.
And
tell me.
Yeah, and the other thing, I found out a few years after that Joseph Smith had like 40 wives and all that. So to me, I think it was a deception, because if I would have known that at that time, I would not have joined the church, you know, and because I think I didn't like Brigham Young to begin with, but I saw Brigham Young just one of those then prophets, then he has his own ideas about, especially with regards to blacks, which I never could understand any explanation that the church gave at the time why. Mm-hmm. I always saw that Brigham Young was a racist, and he actually took over and changed a lot of things. And another thing I was going to mention that also is something that it was traumatized, I would say, in a way for me, was that when I received my patriarchal blessing in 1982, I was told that practically about my whole life was the event that were going to happen if I was faithful. And in one of them told me that I was supposed to become an attorney. And then I was conflicting about it, because since the church keep telling us that we are supposed to be homemakers or have children, and I was going to get married at the time, and I saw, yeah, okay, and I already have gone to college for 2 years, and it was not to become an attorney, it was for something else. So I was conflicted, so I still was going to college after I got married until I had my first child, and then, of course, I was conflicted. I said, well, how am I supposed to be an attorney and a mother? You know, when President Benson is telling us that we need to stay home and raise children and have more children. Mm-hmm. And it was terrible, but I made a decision to drop out of college. Of course, I went back 14 years after, but still, even then, when I went back and finished my degree, is to go to law school will mean to me to leave my children. And I couldn't do that. So for many years, I was feeling so guilty that I was not fulfilling what God was asking me to do.
Right.
That's the goal.
I think
that's the goal, is to have you feel shame if you do one decision, and to feel, you know, you can't really make the other one either, right? So if you go out and work in the workforce, the church is adding shame to you. And if you stay home and raise your kids and didn't want to do that, you wanted to be in the workforce, then you have the burden of being the mother of multiple children that you didn't really want to choose that life. That was a life sort of thrust upon you. But I know you said you had more than one, but I want to just kind of leave it to one person.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, anyway, just want to say.
Kimona?
Oh, okay.
Let me ask a question, okay?
Yes.
And I hope you won't make me regret it, but I just want to ask you this question, okay? Because I thought you were leading up to the point where for a few years you were trying to pursue your career, but you're feeling guilty about it. What did you do because of your guilt feelings?
Well,
did you keep going? Did you keep going with your career, or did you stop it?
Well, what I did after 14 years and I dropped out from college and my kids were all enough that they, you know, my husband could help me. I finished my degree, but then, like I say, I didn't go to law school. And what I did is on my own. I was learning a lot of things and helping people, learning the laws. So I saw, in a way, I comforted myself thinking that, okay, I know some basic laws. I can help people with it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And the other thing that I was told, that I was going to serve a mission with my husband when he retired, and I want to serve in New York City, which I saw what? You know, at the time, I was going to move to another state when I was going to get married. So I say, well, my husband always told me, I don't want to serve a mission when I retire. So there were so many things, you know, and I felt like terrible. Even a friend of mine told me at the time, oh, maybe you might not be married to him and you will remarry and you will marry to somebody else. And then he'll go on a mission with you. And I thought, that's terrible. You know, because that if I would have been like a fanatic, I would say maybe I might have divorced my husband just to accomplish something that supposedly the Lord wants me to do, and I'm glad I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but like I said, during all this time, I just was feeling guilty, you know, that I didn't do the will of God, and I talked to other people, other sisters, and they live with issues like that. And just to mention just the last one, I know you say no more, but you know, that's what I think. There is a lot of issues with the sisters in the church, even when they leave the church, because they're traumatized, because they felt that they just didn't do the will of God, and then now that they're happy, you know, with their life now, they still, they can affect them, that they did the right choice.
It is a heavy thing. It is a heavy thing to be being told that the way you live your life, this is the will of God. And if you want to do it differently, then of course it's going to make you feel guilty because you're going against the will of God. I remember in 1980s when I'm in the student ward at University of Texas at Austin, I'm going to law school and talking with other people who were in college and females struggling with this direction that Ezra Taft Benson had given, quoting President Kimball from 1977, from 10 years earlier. But this was an added emphasis to where it got its own pamphlet called To the Mothers in Zion, asking them to come home to your husbands and your children. And this is where you need to be, not off in the workforce. So there was a lot of struggle and a lot of tears just in this one ward. I'm sure it was happening everywhere in the church at the time with women.
Yes, but actually everything you guys have said, the garments too, yeah, that's what they used to tell us too. They will get protection, the same deal. Now it's different. You know, the same thing that if your children are born in the covenant, you will always have them and they'll have the opportunity to make up if they left. But now President Nelson say, oh no, no way. You're not gonna have them. You have to make sure they are active in the church, they are living their covenants here on this earth, because otherwise after this life, you won't have them.
And if you don't,
that's horrible.
And if they go astray, it's your fault. You just didn't keep them on the straight and narrow.
Right.
So now you got to pay for that.
Yeah, we're gonna end the call. Thank you. Appreciate
thanks for calling.
Thank you so much, guys. Yeah. You're doing great. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
It is a strange thing, RFM, that up until the 2014 or so gospel topic essay on Joseph Smith's polygamy, that no member was taught in official channels, unless you happen to be curious and do a search on Family Search. Yeah. There was no official channel, no correlated curriculum, no lesson manual, no Enzyme magazine that told you anything about Joseph, that your founder was a polygamist, had 33, 34 wives. Some of them were 14-year-old girls. Some of them were the wives of other men. And we tell other stories in the church about most of those women, faith promoting stories in other places.
Right.
Mary Elizabeth Rawlings Leitner, for instance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who wrote all the hymns?
Who wrote all the hymns? You mean Eliza Snow?
Yeah. The words, yes. The poetess, right?
Yeah.
Eliza Snow, we get her name often, never was told she was a plural wife of Joseph Smith.
No, and at the same time, I mean, there's one place in the scriptures where you might stumble upon that information. It would be in section 132, in the last half of section 132. But every 4 years, when church history came around in Sunday school, in the teacher's manual, first off, in the student's manual, it gave us the reading assignment, not the entirety of section 132, but only from verses 1 to 26, if memory serves, which could be interpreted in different ways. Okay, we don't want to get to the parts beyond it where it's very clear what it's talking about, and Emma is being threatened with destruction if she doesn't go along with the polygamy program. But that is the way it was. And so the students themselves, the members themselves in Sunday school are being told only read up to verse 26 in section 132. And in the teacher's manual, it said, don't bring up polygamy. And if somebody else brings it up, then deal with it really quickly, right? In some way that's prescribed in the manual. But under no circumstances were you as the teacher supposed to bring that subject up.
Yeah. All right. I think I've got two more calls in the call bank, and then we'll close out the show. What's the name, caller?
Marzipan.
Yeah, go ahead.
Marzipan.
Hey, I just thought about something that I saw on Facebook the other day from a relative of mine who, well, all my relatives are Mormon, but he was writing it as if he was speaking to God, but he was talking about being 3 years old and everyone at church telling him that whenever he needed to feel loved, that God was always there and that you always just pray and God will take care of everything. Experience was, you know, I'm a kid, I'm from a broken home, my mom's got a mental illness, you know, there's all these things going on in my life. And so you weren't there for me, God. And it was a really painful thing to read, but it also reminded me how much people talk about prayer. And I can admit that I even do this at times, but it's not testable. It's not provable, but you can tell people, oh, God's always there for you. Well, you know, what does that actually mean?
Nothing.
And
we're asking the question.
Exactly.
It means exactly. Nothing.
So it's just another.
Yes.
It's just another, part of not just Mormonism, but religion, I guess.
It's a way to say something that sounds really solid and faith promoting and experiential when it's actually nothing. It's the same thing as when people get up and bear their testimony and they say that God always answers my prayers, even when the answer is no, which means God has never answered a freaking prayer that you gave.
Right. All roads lead to Rome. Thank you, Colin.
Exactly.
That's a great point. Great point.
See,
I will tell you something. I'll share with you a story. No, should I share it? No, it's almost 2 hours. I'll save the story for another day. But it was a huge disappointment I had with God as a 10-year-old when he did not give me what I was praying for, which was for a very, very worthwhile purpose. Did not have to do with me at all. Had to do with the protection of others.
Yeah. Maybe we should do an episode someday where people can just call in and vent about the things that God didn't show up and do for them.
That might unanswered be prayers.
Unanswered prayers. Yeah. All right. Last caller of the night. I believe the name is Mark. Mark, is that the name?
Yes, it is.
All right. Glad
hi. Mormonism alive. Thank you. You know, one thing that's always bothered me, not always, but recently has kind of bothered me, in the Mormon doctrine, it has been implied, or more than implied, that to become a god, you have to have a physical body, right?
Absolutely. And, I'm halfway there.
Okay, right. Well, as we get older, that percentage might deteriorate over time. But anyway,
what kind of slam is that? How old are you, Mark? I hope you're pretty old.
Old enough to know better.
Okay, good.
Old enough to know better. But Jesus or Jehovah was, according to Mormon doctrine, as I understand it, was the God of the Old Testament.
That has been Mormon doctrine since Talmage times, yes.
So how could that be possible if Jesus didn't have a body while he was God of the Old Testament?
Jesus is the exception to every rule, Mark. The sooner you understand that, the sooner you're going back to church.
Don't they call that special pleading?
Yes, of course it is. Very good. He is the exception to every rule.
Yeah.
Well, and I asked this
somehow in the pre-mortal existence.
Right. Well, I asked this of a friend of mine who happens to be a true believer and believing Mormon, not an apologist, but a believer. Mm-hmm. And he came back to me a few days later and he says, well, because Jesus, his birth and embodiment and resurrection was retroactive because he and God always, yeah, I know it gets better because he and God always knew he would have a body eventually in the New Testament.
This sounds like Nephilim.
There's a problem. Well, yeah, there is a little bit of nepotism there. But that brings up another philosophical question that
And why does Jesus, I want to hold on to that next question, Mark. And why is it that Jesus gets all of this, this glory, all this special treatment? Because he's the firstborn, right? Who the hell cares if he's the firstborn? Only begotten. Why is that special? The firstborn in my family, my oldest brother, he's an asshole. There's nothing special about being firstborn. I'm here to tell you.
Right. Well, you'll get no argument from me. But if it was retroactive and God and Jesus always knew that he would have a body, that would be predestiny. And doesn't that annihilate the whole concept of free agency? Did Jesus have a choice?
Okay, I think you just got way too deep for me. I'm still back on the older brother.
Another show, Mark.
And the other thing is that God does know what's going to happen. He knows that I'm going to get a body. He knows that Bill's going to get a body. He knows that you're going to get a body. You get a body and you get a body. He's going to know where the dividing line is. So how come I don't get to be the savior? He knows I'm going to have a body too.
It's like Oprah. You get a car. You get a free car. You get a free car. I mean, I guess I have a fallacy in my philosophical argument. I'm trying to apply logic to something that you get the idea. So anyway, yeah. I'm wondering. You know, I'd love to hear a good answer other than special pleading.
Okay, good answer for what? For why it is that Jesus was able to attain into Godhead before he came down to mortality?
Yeah, and I don't even want to talk about the Holy Ghost.
I have it. I have the answer.
Okay.
Because I figured this out, 35 years ago. Because Jesus had been born on a prior earth and was resurrected and exalted just like his father Elohim had been before him. So he does have a resurrected body of flesh and bones before this earth was even created. So that's how he's God.
Ta-da.
Go ahead. Okay, there's a flaw in there. If he already had a body, why did he have to be born of a virgin? Because
Mark, if you'll just stop long enough, I'll explain this all to you. because he is going from he's advancing in the way that his father did before him, in the way that Adam did after him, and in the way that all of us must advance. Those of us who are fortunate enough and righteous enough to be resurrected and receive celestial glory will have another incarnation. And in their next incarnation, they will be the Adam. This is speaking for the guys, okay? Girls, you'll have to settle for Eve. But the guys will be an Adam in the next world, in their next incarnation. If they do that successfully, then they go on to be a savior like Jesus in the next life, on the next world. And if they do that successfully, then there's nothing stopping them. The sky's the limit, and they are Elohim all the way. Ooh, now,
I can't wait.
So he's kind of like Kane from Kung Fu, going from town to town.
He is, after being allowed to leave the Shaolin Temple once he mastered snatching the pebble from Master Po's hand.
Thank you.
He's a wanderer and an vagabond. But that's how.
That's how.
I worked all this out 35 years ago. I realized that there were intelligent answers to these problems that were presented by Mormon theology, and I was the guy to figure it out.
And I'm afraid I just don't have the education to understand. Hey, thank you so much, fellas. Keep up the good work. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yo, thank you, Mark. You don't have the credibility. Or the credulity, I should say. You don't have the credulity to believe me. That's the problem. You're not gullible enough.
All right. That's the end of the call-ins. RFM, any last thoughts from you before I close out the show?
No, but I've had just a remarkably good time on tonight's show. And I want to thank you, Bill, for having that in the holster to to do when our guest just wasn't able to make it at the last moment. Hopefully, Spencer Anderson will be able to be here next week, and we'll talk about what it was we're going to be talking about tonight. And we'll wish him and his family all the best during the somewhat difficult time that they're going through.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate the good thoughts for him. Folks, I just want to say there are other things where Mormonism has changed. For instance, you get a planet, now you don't get a planet, but both of those claims are unfalsifiable. Sometimes changes are made because the church is embarrassed. Sometimes the church makes changes because it simply has to. We were talking about a specific apologetic method tonight, and I hope you, through those 19 examples, sort of see, I think, a really serious way that the church maintains some sort of ground to claim it's true, when in reality, its truth claims have been proven false left and right. And I hope that you'll see that going forward a whole lot more easily. I wanted to play one last quote from President Monson. We'll close out the show with him. And I think it speaks to some degree of what we talked about tonight. RFM, thank you, as always. And we'll see you guys, folks, next Monday at 6:20 p.m. And hopefully we've got Spencer on. Have an excellent day.
I remember not too long ago, I began to dive into the church history. There, I began to find things contrary to what was taught to me while growing up in primary. On one occasion, I read an account that struck me as odd. I brought this account to my dear bishop, and there I told him of my doubts. He looked at me, and with a twinkle in his eye, he said, "Tommy, you must know, you must doubt your doubts before you doubt your faith." Close quote. I looked at him, and with a twinkle in my eye, I told him, "Why, Bishop, that's complete bullshit.